Okay, thank you. Right, so, and this is mainly based on joint work with Sébastien Bouxon and David Wittnyström. David is hiding in the corner. He's a Swedish-looking Swede. I'm the non-Swedish looking. Okay, and yeah, so okay, press green button. Can I do this? Did it work? No. Yeah, it's okay. Yeah, I can do this. Okay, so first notation. So there was this, we just had a talk with Bloom, and just to really, really, really confuse you, all the notation is inverted. So it's like what was small is big, so small n is capital N, etc. So you really, really have to focus to follow this talk. So X will be a compact complex manifold, and the dimension is small n, small n. So L will be a holomorphic line bundle over X, and I will use, I remind you that a smooth metric on a line bundle is usually written locally with the H notation. So it's H is equal to, and then you can introduce phi. So it's e to the minus 2 phi. And I like to think about metrics in terms of the phi notation. Okay? So if this is an additive object in terms of tensor product, and I just, if I want to just emphasize that it's not H, I call it a weight. Not important, really. And with my conventions, then the normalized curvature is the ddc of phi, and with the pi chosen in such a way that you never see them anymore. So it's the first churn plus of a line bundle will then be represented in ring cohomology by the ddc of phi. Okay. Just a convenient notation. And then when I, so in the talk, actually, a crucial point is that phi will be smooth or continuous, but not necessarily with positive curvature. Then I talk about phi. But then at some point I talk about weights which may be singular, but then they'll have positive curvature. And then I call it psi. So I will also say that something which has positive curvature current is a PSH weight. Just convenient notation, because that's locally true. Okay, that's notation. We'll see if you can follow. No, it's not working. Never mind. I'll do it next time. I'll do this next time. You'll remember the notation. Okay. Okay, so first I want to recall the notion of algebraic volume of line bundles. So this is just, it's not crucial for the talk, but I like to think about, put it in a kind of a geometric context, and we have different levels of invariance. So now I'll talk about the algebraic volume of a line bundle. So given the line bundle, I can define following, I know it goes back to the work of Zariski, I think, so Lazarsfeld has kind of emphasized this point of view more recently. So given a line bundle, I look at the growth of sections of high tensor powers. So in additive notation, that's KL. And I normalize, and in the limb sup, which is actually a limit, is called the volume of the line bundle. Okay. And then it's actually defined just on real cohomology, really, if you think about the first churn class of the line bundle. And then one calls the line bundle big if it has many sections, so if the volume is positive. And the main example, of course, is when the line bundle is ample, or a limit of ample line bundle, so it's NF. And then it's a fantastic thing, really, that then this algebraically or holomorphically defined volume of a line bundle admits a more explicit expression, which is just in terms of intersection theory, it's the nth top power of the first churn class of the line bundle. So, of course, that's just the Riemann-Roch theorem and vanishing, but it's a very beautiful thing, I think, classical. And so analytically, you can think about this line bundle is ample if I can choose this, find a smooth metric which has strictly positive curvature. So it's SPX, SH. Okay, so what happens if the line bundle is merely big? What's the formula? Well, this has been worked out. And so it goes back to work by Fujita in algebraic geometry and Bouxon from the analytical point of view, really. So the volume of the line bundle will be a curvature integral, but you're supposed to now take a metric on the line bundle which has minimal singularities. so you can define that. Never mind. So it has minimal singularities. And then you want to integrate its Mangin pair, but that's only defined where it's locally bounded. So you remove the, so you look at the locus, which is really the bound, the open set where it's locally bounded, or any such Zariski set, open Zariski set, and then you compute its Mangin pair there. And the magic thing is that this gives you the volume of the line bundle. So this point of view was goes back to the work of Buxon. So what about these metrics with minimal singularities? How do we get them? Well, there is a way. They're not canonical. So, I mean, you can have, if you have one, then you have many in a certain sense. So, I mean, there are many, many, many. But there is, given a smooth weight on the line bundle, smooth metric, so I can't plug that in, like in the case of an ample line bundle, because I will get the wrong answer. But given that, I can associate a metric with minimal singularities to it, and this, the, in this context, this goes back to the work of De Maillet, Paternel, and Schneider, I think. So what you do is that you replace the smooth metric with a soup from below, so it's an envelope of all plurisubharmonic things, so positively curved things. Okay, and then you can take this as a definition of minimal singularities, but when you take the soup, you will get the things which are at least minus, they are not so as much minus infinity as they could be. So I will call that, I think of that in terms of an operation. So it's P of phi is the soup. So it, compared to Bloom's talk, that's an extremal function, a weighted extremal function. And I kind of like to draw, think about it in terms of a picture. So in the space of all metrics, I have this. I have this phi, but it's not positively curved. And then I look at the convex set of all positively curved things which are less than or equal to phi. That's a convex set. And then I simply take the element which minimizes the L infinity norm, the distance in the L infinity norm. So it's kind of a canonical projection. And so in the formula, you would have the formula would be volume of L is Mangin pair of P phi for any smooth phi. In this case. So, and I will call the Mangin pair measure here the equilibrium measure of x with the metric phi, with the weight phi. So it depends on the choice here. The point is that the integral over here does not depend on phi, but, I mean, the measure itself does. It's the equilibrium measure. So I have one picture in mind when I think about these things, which I want to share with you. So in the case where it's a toric case, really. So everything will be invariant under a torus action. And in the one-dimensional case, it means that phi will really just depend on a real variable. So I like that. I can draw a graph. Here it is. It's not positively curved because at some points it's positively curved and blah. And there I introduce negative curvature. And the soup thing is, of course, just taking this in terms of graphs, I just take the convex hull. So I have this non-positively curved thing. I replace it with this thing. And then you see, and you compute the Mangin pair, where the convexification is going on. In this particular case, at least, and that's true in general, the Mangin pair vanishes. It's an affine function. So all the contribution is somehow to the single, I mean, the negativity of the curvature is making a hole in the support of the equilibrium measure. It's kind of a good way, I think, to think about these things. So can I do this now? So. Okay. Let's see. Okay. So now you know what the, if you didn't know it before, what the algebraic volume of a line bundle is. So the point is that it's an invariant of the line bundle only. You can express it in terms of metrics, but it depends only on the line bundle. And now I want to then present an invariant which really is a generalization of the volume of a line bundle. It's not important really that it is, but you can think about it in that way. So I can call it the metric or weighted volume, and it's, in terms of pluripotential theory, it's really a capacity. So the point is that you fix the line bundle once and for all. I'll never, ever let it change again. So it's fixed. But what is changing now is the metric. So let's say I have a metric on the line bundle which is smooth. Well, geometrically I can think about that as I look at its unit ball in terms of the L infinity norm in the space of section. Very nice geometrical object. Even if this would be very, very non-regular, really this is at least a nice object, just a ball. Okay, I look at it in the space of sections here. So that's this ball. Okay? And I could, of course, why L infinity? I could take L2 if I choose a measure, and then I will put a subscript 2. So then what is kind of a seducing idea is to just, if I want to define a kind of a volume thing which depends on this metric, I want to hide certain things. I don't want you to go in a lot. Okay, then you want to hide this thing. What do you do? Well, you have this ball, so you want to take its volume. Well, the problem is volume with respect to what? Well, the natural thing is that you want something which is independent of the metric. So you say this is a vector space. It's a ball in a vector space, so I take the Haar measure, the invariant measure. Well, that's just defined up to a multiplicative constant. So then you're stuck. So the key point is that this volume is a bifunctional. It's the only reasonable way to do it is to define it on pairs of metrics. Because then you can simply divide by one with the other and this arbitrary factor goes away. So it's is well defined. You may choose the Haar measure in any way you want, and this bifunctional will be defined. So let me define it more precisely. I do this for each k. I have a ball in the space of sections of kl, and I take the log and I do certain rescaling, which turns out to be the correct one, and then I take a lim sup of that. So then I will get an invariant of this pair. And I don't put, I want to do this in L infinity, but the point is that you get the same thing, if you do it in L2. So I don't put, that's the consequence of the theorem. So now we have somehow a bifunctional on the space of all metrics. And why is this the generalization of the volume of a line bundle? Well, there's a trivial observation that if I first take phi here, and then as the other one, I just take phi plus 1. Well, then if you think about this, then you what you get here from scaling of balls is the dimension of the space they live in, right? That's why it's good to have the log. So it's actually just giving you back the dimension of the space and the limit, which is the volume of the line. So if you want, you can think about it as a generalization of the algebraic volume, which now depends on a pair of metrics. And then the analog of this kind of way where you want to express concretely an object which is algebraically or defined in terms of holomorphic things, you want to express it in terms of some kind of a more plurisubharmonic thing like Monge-Ampère or something. So here's the theorem. This theorem with Buxon. This you can find on the archives. And so the statement is, let's say that phi and phi prime are continuous. So there is a more general statement, like in Bloom's talk, that would corresponding to, for example, having a compact set where they are defined, and then you define them as infinity on the complement. That works. But just, to be more concrete, for me the concrete setting is actually when there is not a compact, but the weight. So in Bloom's talk, the concrete setting was when there were no weights, but a compact. So it's I kind of prefer only having weights. But of course, it's a matter of taste. But then, here's the formula. This volume, ball volume, limit of growth rate of balls, can be written as a bifunctional. So let me first of all, you want to get a plurisubharmonic object, positively curved thing. So you replace both of them with the projections. You get the soup or all plurisubharmonic things. Okay, so now I have an object which is two objects which are purist harmonic, and then it's explicit. After you've done that, the function is explicit. So you take this mixed Monge-Ampère type energy thing. So the important thing is that it just depends on the differences here. So the zero-dimensional thing somehow would be just the difference. But then you take all the mixed Monge-Ampères in a democratic way, so with the same constant, and then, well, there's a certain normalization factor. And that's it. So that's the theorem, which is kind of the main theorem I want to discuss. So just some comments about this then. So let's first check. I mean, does this give back the old result? Just consistency check. Okay, so this, when I take these, I apply to this iteration psi, comma psi plus 1, I should get the old volume. Okay, we can do this. Here I just get the same thing all the time, so you just get the Monge-Ampère. Here I get 1. Ah, so it's the total integral of the Monge-Ampère away from the singularity. Yes, it's working. Whew. Okay, good. Okay, so that's good. And so, of course, this, I mean, it's kind of difficult to do something really new in mathematics. So this object is not new, even if you sometimes think it is. So this goes back really to, I mean, there are different points of view. So this is an example of a secondary characteristic class. These were introduced by Both Chern. It's very crucial in the work of Bismuth G. Soulé in Oracle of Geometry. Even if you, I mean, it's kind of more abstract, so you don't really never see the precise formula, but it's there. There's another point of view. I mean, it turns up from another point of view in our paper, but also that point of view is not new either. Too bad or too good, I don't know. Is that this goes back to the work of Aubin Mabuchi, is that this functional, if you forget about these projections, this functional turns up as a primitive of the Monge-Ampère operator. So more precisely, if I fix the second variable, which I will always think as of as some kind of reference, you always need to define everything with respect to something. So the second guy here, no batteries anymore? No? Running out of batteries. Okay. Modern technology, worthless without batteries. So what it is that you have this functional. I'm fixing the second variable. So it's a functional on the space of metrics. And then I can look at its differential. The differential of a functional abstractly, well, for fixed point, it's a functional. So I can represent it as a measure, as integration against the measure. So the differential is a measure. And that measure at psi is the Monge-Ampère. It is working. Ha. It's a fantastic formula. So this, which Obama Mabuchi realized, because that, I mean, first of all, it shows that this one form is closed. Right? That's something it's not obvious, you just have to check that. But that's really the fundamental property. This functional is the primitive of the Monge-Ampère operator. Okay, yeah, but then there are some crucial properties that we found, which are really, really, for the application I have in mind, they're absolutely crucial, somehow more important than the theorem itself. Well, never mind. So the first thing is that this functional, I already told you that it's differentiable. Of course, I mean, the fact that it's differentiable is trivial without the P. But the magic thing is that when you put the P in, first project, then you apply the functional, then it's differentiable. And, why not? But the key point is that, for example, it's not two times differentiable in general. So that's really something special. And the surprising point, if you think about it, is what are you doing? You have a functional, but you first project on a convex set. That projection is never differentiable at the boundary. It's just, that does not happen. Never. more or less. And then you compose it, and then suddenly it's differentiable. It's just, think of the chain rule. It's just, it's weird. It's just, how can that be? So it's just that these guys, P and E, are they really, or beautiful E, they really belong together. I mean, it's a kind of a marvelous thing that this works out. And so it's not two times differentiable, but still it's concave. So the second derivatives are negative. And this concavity is actually quite easy to prove. So that's less involved. Okay, so just let me give an example which will kind of put this in the framework of Bloom's talk in one variable. So as I said, there is a way of getting something new in mathematics. So if we do this in one variable, then it's very well known. So I take X to be P1 and L to be the over one line bundle. So the sections of KL are the homogeneous polynomials of degree K. And to make it more concrete, I take an affine piece in P1, I remove infinity, and now I can represent my weight with just a function on C, well, with a logarithmic growth at infinity. And the reference weight phi prime, I fix it as the log of maximum of 1 and w, and the absolute value of z, log plus. Okay. And once I've done that, I can talk about the volume of this ball, because even if I don't write it out, it means that I've chosen the Haar measure so that it's 1 on the prime thing. So let's just call that a vol prime, so you never see the other things. So what's this thing? Geometrically it's nice, the ball volume, but in a space of sections, so it's not very, very concrete. Well, then there is a very nice formula. You can see that this, I mean, that's not obvious, but what it gives is, at least when k tends to infinity, the leading term will be just, you'll get it in the following way. So you can think about, if you want to compare with Bloom's trick, you take phi to have it to be infinity on the complement of a compact set. I mean, that's actually okay. Even if I said it's continuous, that's okay. And okay, so they all, so now you think about take for each k, I take, well, k plus 1, okay, particles or points in this set, and for each such configuration, well, it's really in the you can think of Steve's talk, I have a configuration of points, and to get a number, I want to take like the geometric mean distance, so I just multiply all the mutual distances. And dependence on phi is that I take the weighted distance in this absolute values. Okay? Okay, that will give me a number for each configuration. You could take phi to be zero on E2. That will give me a kind of a mutual distance thing. And then to get a number that's for each configuration, I take a soup over all configurations. That's a number. And in the limit, this will give me this volume thing without the logarithm. So that's really, as in Bloom's talk, that's what is called the transfinite weighted transfinite diameter. So that's a very well-known object. And as he said too, so okay, so you can think about this physically. So physically, well, you introduce the log, there's a minus somewhere, I don't know, and suddenly this is an inf over energies. So you take log of distances, well, that's physically, it means that you're, for each configuration, they have a Coulomb internal energy, electric internal energy, by just summing up all the minus logarithms, which is really acting as it's kind of repulsive, because if you want to minimize, you want them to be distant, I mean, far away from each other. Well, but then you also have this potential term, psi, which is kind of you think of an uphill potential, so when they want to go away, they get really tired, and they go back, and at some point they're in equilibrium. And if you look at the limit of that equilibrium, distribute energy at equilibrium, that's the invariant. That's the vol of psi, log zero, in my notation. And here you can also see a bit more structure. So in this concrete case, it means that the invariant itself is the energy at equilibrium, and the equilibrium measure is this physically the limiting positions of particles in equilibrium. That will be the Monge-Ampère of P-phi in this case. So it's a very concrete thing in terms of physics, and I'll just quickly mention that if you try to do the same thing in higher dimensions, when you try to prove a formula like this, there is a step in between where you have a van der Monde type determinant. And as Blue mentioned, in one variable you can factorize it, but there is no such charming formula as said in higher dimensions, and that's somehow the beauty of the theory. You have to do something else. But if you just define that as you can define that as a transfinite diameter anyway, following Leia, Polish mathematician from 59, I think he did that. So in the unweighted case, when they're phi zero but on a compact support, this was actually calculated very recently by Ramilly and Ramilly DeMarco, who used arithmetic intersection theory. So maybe if I have time, I mention they are. I mean, this is closely related to arithmetic intersection theory. Oh, wrong order. So really, I mean, I have a slide about arithmetic volumes, but I just really quickly mention it. So you're interested in this, I mean, I'm glad to talk about it, but it's a sidetrack, really. So I'll just say that, since this workshop has arithmetics in its name somewhere, so I'll just say that if the manifold X is an arithmetic variety, whatever that means, then in terms of Reclow geometry, this weight of a line bundle, they think about it as happening over infinity, right? And so you're looking at its line bundle of the complex points, and then the key point in arithmetic, when you have this extra structure of having an arithmetic variety, it means that you don't have to choose a reference weight. The arithmetic structure will pick it out for you in a different way. So this volume now, with respect to the Z structure somehow, is that you take the Haar measure, which is 1 normalized on a certain fundamental domain. Namely, you can talk about integer sections defined over Z. So on Pn, that would just be, you know, polynomials with integer coefficients. And well, then you say, that's the lattice, so I take a fundamental domain. I can normalize with respect to that. So this was actually the way Gilly and Soulier did it originally in their paper on arithmetic Riemann rock. So this is really a precursor. That's the motivation for our definition, really. I mean, one of the motivations. And here's a trivial observation, but useful. So even if it depends on two things, arithmetic structure and the metric structure. But when you study, as will be important for equidistribution theorems, variations with respect to the metric, the arithmetic structure goes away because, you know, it's constant. So I think you can do this formula too, like clearing denominator, if you look at it. So the difference between these different arithmetic volumes is really just the volume of phi relative phi prime. So all the arithmetic goes away. And then actually, so we noticed that you can use this to prove a generalization of an equidistribution theorem recently proven by Yuan, where you look at equidistributions of points of small height. But I mean, if you're interested, let's talk about it, because it's a bit of a sidetrack, but it's the same kind of ideas which come into it. Okay, so how could you go about proving this formula relating the volume of the line bundle, of these balls of sections to some energy
formula.
Well, that's where the hero enters the story, the Bergman measure. So I'm very, as you might have noticed, I'm very fond of Bergman kernels, so here they are. So let me remind you what it is. It occurred in previous talks, but I'll just repeat that. So the point is that given a weight function phi and k, which is a k in the tensor power of L, I can get a measure, but I also need to choose some auxiliary volume form or measure. Here I will take just a volume form, and this will give me a smooth, nice measure, which I get by, look at the space of all sections. Well, that's a Hilbert space if I use the corresponding L2 norms. So I have a Hilbert space. I have a Hilbert space, I have an orthonormal basis. Okay, I take one. And then to get a function, I just sum up the pointwise norms of these guys. That will give me a function, and to get a measure, I just multiply with the volume form. Okay? And canonically, it's really a measure you get, because if you would take a measure, can do this with something else in a volume form, for example, supported on a compact set, then the Bergman function is not canonically defined on the complement of the, if you just have this function, because you want to take data, the metric, on the compact set. So it's really the natural thing is to make it a measure, really. Okay, so what this means is that given this weight and the reference measure, I have another measure, the Bergman measure. Why would we care about that? Well, here's the key formula. So we want to understand the limit of these functionals on the space of metrics. So you should think about this reference as being fixed. So it's a functional of phi. It's a sequence of functionals. Well, Newton taught us how to calculate things, right? You differentiate and you try to calculate the derivative, and then, well, you use the integral formula. So that's the key point here, too. So I want to understand its functional. I look at its functional derivative. That's a measure, as I said before. So this will give me some kind of canonical measure. What can it be? Well, it's the Bergman measure. If you normalize things, it comes out in this way. It's a kind of a funny thing. You have these Bohr volumes as a functionals. You take the functional derivative. That will give you a measure on the manifold. That's the Bergman measure. And as I said, there is nothing new in mathematics, so this was kind of very much used by Donaldson in a similar context. Slightly different, but exactly the same thing. And it's not a deep thing. I mean, once you write it down, you're just differentiating a logarithm of a determinant, it's a trace, blah, blah, blah. It's very elementary to prove. But extremely useful, because to understand its functional, I now have its functional derivative. Can we compute that in the limit? Well, luckily enough, at least I could, because I had worked a lot on these things. So I proved in some year ago that's important. So in the case of smooth metrics with a smooth volume form, then the limit of these things is a Monge pair. Well, it's a positive measure, it cannot be the Monge pair of phi, that could be negative. But it is the Monge pair of p phi, where you take this extremal thing, you take the super. So it's, this is true for smooth things, and this is not that true either. So it goes back to people that were really interested, usually one is interested in non-positively curved things. So Tian, I think, was the first, and Bush, independently, I think, prove this for a smooth metric with positive curvature. And then, of course, a lot more is known. It's a pointwise convergence uniformly. You can have a complete asymptotic expansion, etc., etc., etc. But the key point is here that when you have non-regular things, and even in this case, I have no idea how to go beyond the leading term. Very interesting problem, but or I don't have very clear ideas about it anyway. It's a very interesting problem, but a very difficult one, I think. So, okay, but we just need the leading term. It's the Monge-Ampère measure. Very good. Okay, but hey, then we're ready. I mean, we're ready because we have computed the limit of differentials. We can integrate that. That will give us a formula. And that's what we did. And it kind of looked very strange. It's just not the formula you kind of expect. It's strange. But then the magic thing is that this Monge-Ampère is really differential of the beautiful E functional composed with P. So then you know exactly that what you get in the limit of these ball volumes, they must be equal to this beautiful E composed with P. Because you want to understand it's functional for phi equal to the reference, phi prime is zero, everything is zero, and their differentials are the same in the limit, so they have to be the same. That's the very simple idea. And then, well, I've been cheating a bit because I've computed L2 balls, really. But then you can see that because everything is nice, I mean, the measure is nice, the L2 balls and the L infinity balls are equivalent in the limit, I mean, asymptotically, with the right, I mean, the leading contribution will give the same. It's a very simple thing to see. And like we all, I mean, that's what we do often in analysis, right? You replace L2 with L infinity for holomorphic things. And more generally, that would be true for Bernstein-Markov measures, for example, but never mind. Okay, but there's some point I have not discussed, and that's I claim that it's true for continuous phi, and that's not only smooth, and even worse than continuous. So how can that be? Well, one possibility would be to extend this convergence. But I tried quite hard at that time, and it's very difficult. The point is, in the smooth case, this limit is a pointwise almost everywhere limit, because everything is pointwise defined. Well, if you just have a continuous thing, that this Monge-Ampère can be extremely bad. It can be supported on some strange set. For example, in dynamics, that's a particular case. The Julia set would be a special case of that. That's really bad. It's a really bad set. So it's kind of difficult to work on this directly. I mean, you could try to approximate, but it's very difficult on the level of measures. I mean, I could see, I mean, it's very difficult. But then the magic thing is that it works if you're not interested specifically in this thing, but on the higher level of metrics, as a functional on metrics, not the measure. Because, as I said, it's a capacity in the sense that everything is monotone with respect to the weight. And also it's continuous with respect to monotonic limits. And once you notice that, then if it's true on the smooth things, you just approximate them from below, from above, and use monotonicity and continuity, and then it will just fall out. So it's a crucial thing. It's simple, but very, very crucial. And then you can even do it for if you have a compact set, you can approximate two, etc., etc. If it's non-pluripolar, polar, not regular. But I mean, this is the key point. All right. So, well, I've been going quite fast. Time. Okay, so let me apply this to get some equidistribution theorem. Or, no, that's not the slide I was looking for. Kind of weird. Ha. Here's the slide. Here's the slide.
Okay.
So what do I mean with equidistribution? So really, many cases we want to see like this. So it will be a generalization of these fricative points, for example. So you want to look at some cloud of points, and in the limit get a measure. But actually, so the theorem will be more general. It will be an equidistribution for just sequences of probability measures. Then it's formulated in terms of a functional. So slight variation of what I'm doing gives a functional on pairs, not only many objects in this game. So now we fix the line bundle, we fix the reference weight. Once for all, don't think about it anymore. So this is fixed, etc. But now I can think about a functional which depends on the weight phi, and also on a measure. So for each k, I get the measure mu k and k phi. So it depends on these two things. So these two things together define L2 norm on the Hilbert space of sections in KL. So I have an L2 norm, so I have a volume. So I can do the old construction, but the difference is that it also depends, I make it explicit, we depend on the measure too. Okay? The nice thing with that is that then I could take the measure to be just Dirac, for example. Very non-singular, a very singular thing, but that works. You could do that. Okay, and this functional too has a more more familiar expression, for example, in random matrix theory. So it's just a volume in a L2 ball volume. Well, that's a determinant, right? It's a Gram-Schmidt determinant. So it means that I take my reference will give me this orthonormal base, and then I look at all its scalar products. That's a large matrix. But with respect to this new, these other things, so it's not an orthonormal anymore. So the dependence on phi and mu you see here. So this is very reminiscent of Donaldson's L function. So generalization of that, if you want.
Is it a generalization? I mean, this function is just all possible Hermitian measures. Hermitian and product on the space of sections.
No, they're different functional. This is one of them. The L functional. Okay, from my point of view, it's not a generalization. I mean, let's talk about that later. I mean, at some point, it pulls everything back to by Frobenius to the space of all metrics on the line bundle. So it's one of his functions. Things like this. I mean, there are many. The Z function, the L function. But never mind. So I mean, I just want to point out that it shows up in his work. So it's just to say that it's not completely new. Here's the theorem. And so this theorem is joint with Sébastien Buxon and David Wittmerström over there. And this is actually not on the archive yet because it supersedes two of our papers. I think this is the right point of view. So we're writing a new article where it's just a new, slightly more natural way of formulating things. Here's the statement. The statement is that if I now fix my weight, I have this physically the external field fixed, and I take a special sequence of measures. You could think about it as configurations on points. So I want to take those which minimize something, or even weaker, it's supposed to be asymptotically minimizing in the sense that the value of this functional where I fixed phi, I think about it as a functional of the measure, the limit is the inf over all possible limits you could get in this way. And that inf is actually, you can see, one can check that it's actually this old invariant of R. So I have a something more general, that the possible infimum is the invariant I had. Just like physically, you can talk about energy of configurations, but there is a particular one, or limiting one, it's the minimal and possible energy. So I say I have these measures whose kind of energy or L-functional is minimal in the limit. Then the theorem is that you'd like something to be equidistributed. And what is equidistributed is that given the measures, it's not, naively you would think that the measure converges to the Mohr pair. That's not true. But what is true is that the corresponding Bergman measures converge to the equilibrium measure. So let me remind you that you form it using orthonormal basis and etc. I will just give you a concrete example later. So let me also say already that if the measures I started with were delta measures on configurations of points, then you do get back the same measure here.
So the SIs here were orthonormal with some fixed mu?
Yeah.
Because that's why you don't have your usual C and T prime.
Exactly.
You fix it with
we'll fix that. Specific. Yeah. And it's independent.
Okay, you fix some specific.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I mean, you can't, yeah. Yeah, or once and for all you fix phi prime and then take K phi prime, etc. But it's not important actually because it will be as long as it tends to you can fix do it in any way you want.
That
it doesn't matter.
That, you know, the SIs are orthonormal.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Volume measure, for example.
Exactly.
We fix that once and for all. We don't think about it anymore. It's a reference. But you minimize these things. Okay, how would you go about proving that? It seems that it fits into the other things, but before I just talked about an invariant. Now I kind of minimizing something. So how does it work? And this took some time to realize how to formulate it. It's the only thing which comes in now, given what I've told you. It's a completely trivial, simple one-variable lemma, which, if you know a reference for me, I would kind of be glad because I'm sure it's been known for 2,000 years, but it's just that took some time for us to realize that this is what is going on. So here's the thing. I'm going to define a sequence of functions, fk of t, and a limiting object somehow, which is f of t. So fk of t you get in the following way. I have my minimizing sequence. Okay? So I have the L functional at phi and mu k, for example. But since I want to prove a convergence on the level of measures, I also fix a test function, which will be I will test the convergence on that test function. So it goes into the functional by defining the value of the L functional for the perturbed weight, which is perturbed using t. Here's the thing. It just depends on t, because all the other things are actually given. And then I do the same thing with the limit. I perturb what I expect to get in the limit to make it a functional of t. Okay. I have fk of t and f of t. And, let me first of all just rephrase the fact that it's this limit, I have this limiting property. So for t equal to 0, I've set up things so that fk of 0 converges towards f of 0. Just check the notations, this is the idea of the notation. Sorry. Yeah, everything is fixed. Phi prime is so I fixed. I don't write it out. Phi prime is fixed. So what do I know? The data I had goes into t equal to zero. What do I know if t is not zero? Well, then I do know something, which will be enough. I don't have fk of t conversion to f of t because you see. It's like having a configuration which minimizes with respect to the potential phi. It will not be the minimal one with respect to phi plus tu anymore. Well, but it will be larger than the minimal one. That we know. So I have an inequality for all t. So physically, this is really natural. So this was physics do in what is called linear response theory in statistical mechanics. So you want to understand an equilibrium, and then you say, well, I put on some exterior field and see how it reacts. Like, ooh, they will move around. And then you see, look at that, you linearize the response, and that's an important quantity. So usually some correlation function. So this is kind of one inspiration for doing this. And, okay, so I have these things, and then I claim, if I have such a situation, and the very important thing is that, so first of all, this FK will be concave. This can be checked. And the limit as well. But most importantly, the limit is differentiable. That's very, very important for this to work. You will see that. Because if I have that, then there's just one variable lemma, which will tell you that I have more than point-wise convergence at zero. I have convergence at the level of derivatives too. You know, I mean, if you think about it, it's quite fantastic. I mean, how can you transform point-wise convergence to just difference saving? That's not possible, but it's possible if, I mean, look at this proof by picture. I have all, so think about this FK as even affine, not concave. In many cases, they will be affine, and you can reduce it simply to this case. So I have all these lines, and the green thing is the graph of F. And they're all on one side, and in the limit, they go through this point. And this graph is differentiable, so, I mean, they will have to line up in the tangent direction. There's no way they can just stay away. So then they would cut the hole inside the graph. It's just a very, very simple thing. Proof is one line, algebraic. And then you also see how crucial it is that F be differentiable, because if it's not, then if it has a kink here, then you have two limiting possible positions. In physics, this corresponds, what I'm proving is what is called an absence of a first-order phase transition. And if it's not differentiable, I could have two coexisting minimal states, macroscopic states. So that's, I mean, it's kind of the idea. It's very motivated by statistical mechanics, really. But it's, I mean, you don't have to think about it like that. I forgot to do this thing. And I should also say that argument is not that new either. So if you look at the proof of the arithmetic equidistribution theorem by Ulmo, Shang, and Spiro, then it's very similar too. But it just took some time to realize that. Yes. Okay, so let me give you examples of this equidistribution theorem. So first of all, it proves this convergence of Fick to points in higher dimensions. So this, I guess, it's a conjecture in pure potential theory, which goes back to the work of Leia, Kiak, I don't know. I'm sure Bloom knows. No, if I miss somebody. So the thing is that in this case, I just look at the discrete case. I have measures mu k, which are just point masses. Equal weight on all point masses, I get a probability measure, and the number of points is the dimension of the space, and I take this maximizing property in terms of, so this is really in terms of Steve's map, so I have a probability measure, but in this case it's discrete, so I can look at it at the configuration space level. So it means that this extremal property here will mean that it maximizes for fixed k a certain van der Monde type determinant. So these S are the basis I was talking with Steve about that I fixed. So in Pn, that would be the monomial basis. And then you maximize this for a given phi, but you could also think about fixing a compact set and looking phi the infinity outside it. So it's the Bloom was discussing this. So you minimize that. And then this will actually mean that you minimize, this will mean that you're actually minimizing the previous function in terms of measures. Then the equidistribution theorem is that these this cloud of point is equilibrium distributed in the limit. So then you say, hey, where is the Bergman measure? Anybody? The thing is that in the discrete case, then the Bergman measure is this measure. You just, it's like discrete orthogonal polynomials. You work, you just see that it's, this is what you get. And it also solves some conjecture. Well, for, it was formulated by Bloom and Levenberg in a quite recent paper, but I think it goes back. I mean, it's a very natural question. I think, I don't know, it's, but this is probably the first time it was formulated, but it's a very natural thing, is that here's the opposite situation. I will not fix K. I take the measure to be not point masses, but fixed once and for all, but supported on, say, a compact set in Cn, for example. So I'm in Cn, or could be supported on, say, a nice domain in Rn, the green thing. And so I take Lebesgue measure on this domain. And then the equidistribution now means that the following... Bergman measures converge so it's like in terms of multivariate polynomials so I'm using it so I, my weight is just zero on a domain so I take just the orthonormal polynomials and I orthonormalize them and look at total degree at most k and then this limit will then converge to the equilibrium measure of this in terms of classically Sitziak's extremal function. Okay, so and then finally I will just say something which ties in with the previous talk, the statistical aspect. So this is something which I've just written up, so if anybody wants to have a copy, I would be very, very glad to give it away. To have comments, it will be great if you're interested in this. So there are some probabilistic aspects. I'll just very quickly mention this. So, and it also ties in with Steve's talk. So now I think about the configuration space of all points for given k and nk dimension. You could think about this as the kind of you have a space of dimension n of all sections. You think of them as particles. Somehow think of them as particles on your manifold. And I want to put an actual probability measure on that configuration space by just, but not like the, I'm putting it directly on this configuration space, by, as if using the fundamental determinant, just like Bloom's talk. So I fixed something, so I fixed the weight, it will depend on the weight phi, and then I form this fundamental type determinant, and you divide in this way, and it turns out that's really a probability measure. So I have an ensemble of configuration. Okay? So if I have this, then by just abstract nonsense, it means that I have a random measure. Given a configuration, I look at the point measure on these things. So it's a point process in probability, and it's a determinantal point process in terms of probability notation. And then what you can prove, and that's quite direct given what I've told you, is that not only what I just told you is that the minimal configuration will turn to the equilibrium measure. But actually, that's true for any random configuration in a certain sense. So, formally, a random configuration converges in probability to the equilibrium measure. And more interestingly, there is a central limit theorem. That's, I mean, far more involved. And so it means that when you study fluctuations around this convergence, like in classical probability theory, so I say it in word, then you actually get something in the limit, but now I have to test it on some test function, I have to assume that it's supported in the bulk in the equilibrium measure. But if you think about the positively curved case, then there are no assumptions at all. And then the statement is that this converges in distribution to a centered Gaussian, with a variance which depends on the test function, but in probability notation it actually means that the fluctuations converge to the Gaussian free field supported in the bulk. Okay, I think I'll stop there. Thank you.